Exploding drones and missile strikes as overnight Russian attacks bombard towns across Ukraine.
Quite a nervous evening for Ukrainians.
Plus, Russia's full-scale invasion is also threatening the lives of journalists bearing witness to the war.
It's going to create more and more black holes around the world where journalists are not going to dare to go and report because they know they're going to face scrutiny and target.
And later in the program, how some Ukrainian women continue to create handcrafted products for export despite the destruction. Today is Friday, March 31st. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Lori London in Washington. President Joe Biden is urging Russia to release an American journalist, telling reporters at the White House on Friday his message to Russia is simple.
Let him go.
Russia's Federal Security Service arrested Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich on charges of espionage on Thursday. It's the first time an American journalist has been detained on accusations of spying since the Cold War. The journal has said it vehemently denies the charges. The Biden administration is also warning U.S. citizens not to travel to Russia and for Americans in the country now to depart immediately. On November 22, 2012, American journalist James Foley was kidnapped in northern Syria by the Islamic State. He was killed on August 19, 2014, by that terrorist group. Since then, his mother, Diane Foley, now the president and founder of the James W. Foley Legacy Foundation, has worked to fight for the release of other Americans wrongfully detained overseas. I spoke with Diane about the arrest of Evan Gershkovich.
It's a new low for Russia-U.S. relations in many ways to, just so blatantly arrest a very accredited journalist who's been in country for a number of years. It's just frightening to me. It's very troubling because, you know, then he joins four other U.S. nationals who are wrongfully detained at present, including Paul Whelan, who's now been held 4 long years. When state actors start taking out people, that is concerning.
You bring up a good point. Your son, James, who was also a journalist working in Syria, was kidnapped and killed by the Islamic State, which was a terrorist group. But it seems like now we have foreign governments intent on taking hostage to make a trade or for political leverage. And, you know, in the midst of this horrific war in Ukraine and the U.S. support of Ukraine, would you say this probably has a lot to do with that? Or is this just standard now that we have a foreign government doing this?
It's been increasing. There's no question. I mean, 10 years ago, you're right on. It was terrorist groups, criminal gangs, pirates who were primarily doing this. But in this decade, we've seen a steady but sure increase in state actors taking out people. Actually, our research shows that 75% of U.S. nationals currently held are held in Iran, China, Venezuela, Syria, and Russia, instead of, you know, with criminal or hostage or terrorist groups, if you will. So that's very concerning because when someone is taken by a government in a wrongful detention, it is often interferes directly with our foreign policy, economy, and of course the safety of Americans traveling abroad. But it is much more difficult to negotiate, actually. Very difficult, because often state captors want all kinds of crazy things in exchange for an innocent citizen of ours. So we're finding that people are held longer. And even though recently, thank God, we've had some releases, but those were the work of many years, and both government and non-government partners, as well as strategic international partners like Qatar, Belgium, other countries helping out also. So they're very complex, Lori. And so I'm glad people have been made aware right away. So hopefully, if we can act as quickly as possible to intercede with Evan and give as much proof as possible to his innocence, the sooner the better, because we're finding that the longer a person is held hostage or wrongfully detained, the more difficult it is to get them home.
if these countries are seemingly using American citizens as political weapons under the guise of arresting them, accusing them of so-called crimes, would that also contribute to making it more complicated?
Absolutely. And that's why at the Foley Foundation, we're particularly concerned, because our current hostage enterprise was developed with a very narrow scope on terrorists, criminals, or pirates taking out people. That is non-state actors. And because now the majority of people taking our citizens have flipped and is 75% state actors, it's infinitely more complex. And that's partly why we're calling on Congress to do a complete reevaluation of the hostage enterprise to see how it does interfere with our foreign policy and how to deter it. For one thing, we must deter this horrific practice, but we also at the same time need to find ways to diplomatically get people out, but to deter the practice of using our citizens as political clout.
At the same time, if we trade, if we go the route of trading to get our loved ones home, our citizens home, is that sort of counterintuitive? Is it just giving them more incentive to do it again for bargaining?
We have no research that says that. We need research on it. We really don't. There's no, what it says now is that if we don't negotiate, like they didn't for us on Jim Foley, Stephen Sotloff, Kayla Mueller, Peter Kasich, Luke Summers, and Warren Weinstein during the 2014-2015, our people die. That's the result. Not that we're taken more often, but that our people fare much worse than other Western nations. When Jim was taken, he was taken with 18 to 20 of our other allies, and all the other European countries found a way to negotiate them out. All but the British and American, who chose not to negotiate, and therefore all of the citizens died. So I just think our country has a moral obligation to have the backs of brave citizens when they're out in the world performing a service, such as a journalist or aid worker or international business person, educator, to have the backs of our citizens. I feel that's part of our government's moral responsibility.
The tragedy that hit home for you, losing your son, you really made this a mission to turn your own personal tragedy into helping other families that are going through this. What is your ultimate goal and how you keep going?
Well, I keep going just because of my faith in God and the goodness of people. I think when bad things happen, people have to stand up and try to seek the good out of it. Jim certainly would have wanted that. So he challenges me every day to try to make some good out of the horror of all this. But our mission consists of two real main pillars. One is advocacy for the return of U.S. nationals who are wrongfully detained or kidnapped abroad. We do advocacy within the government through the hostage enterprise, which includes working with people at the NSC, the White House, State Department, and FBI. But also we work on the Hill. We engage as much as we can. A real foundation of our engagement are with the families themselves. Every year, we do a confidential qualitative assessment with families who are currently going through this ordeal so that they might confidentially feel free to tell us the obstacles they're encountering, so we can study trends. Then the second pillar is our preventative safety education that originally we started for aspiring journalists. We are currently at over more than 20 schools and recently have an initiative translated into Arabic that's about to begin in Lebanon. But just this last week, we actually put out a guide of traveler safety for any American who seeks to travel internationally, because we're concerned. We really feel that Americans are increasingly being targeted for wrongful detention or kidnapping. What we're finding is, particularly when state actors take our people, people held longer and longer. It is very difficult to get them out if we don't get them out in the first 3 to 6 months. The longer they're there, the more difficult it is.
Given the tensions with Russia and the U.S., particularly when it comes to the U.S. support of Ukraine and Russia's full-scale invasion, Would you say that this is another act of sort of desperation in using these people as weapons?
No question about that, Lori. And that's what's frightening, is they're starting to use this under the ploy of justice, if you will, like a rightful detention, you know, for an arrest for a crime. They're using it to target innocent people who are doing their job. And what's frightening is it's going to create more and more black holes around the world where journalists are not going to dare to go and report because they know they're going to face scrutiny and targeting. It is a new low for diplomatic relations between Russia and our country, certainly.
And of course, there's the very strong issue of press freedom and the suppression and the propaganda that's coming along with this war.
And if we can't even have a neutral, if journalists, you know, they used to be considered in last World War, at least, more of a neutral party that both sides kind of relied on them to bring the news from the conflict, but not so anymore. Now, certain countries want to skew the news the way they want for their people. And they don't want the truth. I'm just very concerned about Evan and his family. I'm just grateful that we know about it right away and that hopefully our government is able to engage as soon as possible. They're using this arrest as a direct assault on our government, on our people.
Diane Foley, president and founder of the James W. Foley Legacy Foundation, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for covering this very important story.
Russia continued its bombardment of Ukraine on Friday, launching a barrage of missile strikes, shells, exploding drones, and gliding bombs across the country that killed more civilians, damaged residential buildings, roads, and homes, and caused major fires. I got an update on this very difficult 24 hours from correspondent Anna Chernikova, reporting for VOA from Kyiv.
It was quite a tough late evening yesterday. For some cities, it was even more difficult than for the rest. It was a drone attack across the country, particularly targeting north and central areas. This attack started late in the evening yesterday. According to the general staff and to the Air Force of Ukraine, 10 drones that Russian forces launched from Bryansk region, which is north border with Ukraine side, targeting Kyiv and Kyiv region as well. No casualties were reported and 9 out of 10 drones were shut down. No explosions were reported in Kyiv and Kyiv region. It was quite a nervous evening for Ukrainians. However, another big attack, a really bad one, was happening at the same time in the city of Kharkiv. This was not a drone attack. According to the Kharkiv local authorities, it was a C-300 missile attack. At least 6 hits were reported in the city of Kharkiv. There is information about damages of the private building and of a couple of civilian vehicles. No information yet regarding victims, but definitely the city of Kharkiv was probably the hottest area in terms of airstrikes last evening. Also, we should mention, of course, the Zaporizhia attack. Unfortunately, Zaporizhia is under fire constantly, but particularly in this last 24 hours, a couple of explosions and a couple of attacks across that area was reported as well.
And Anna, all of this bombardment, as Ukrainians have been commemorating the anniversary of the liberation of Bucha, which was the scene of horrific atrocities.
Bucha became, unfortunately, it became famous for horrific atrocities committed by Russian forces in that little city, little town during February and March of 2022 during Russian occupation. The whole world saw these first images from Bucha of bodies on the streets, people with bodies with the signs of torture, mass graves, people shut down on their bicycles with their dogs sitting next to them waiting for help. So it was really, really terrible images and quite shocking images. And today, President Zelensky in the morning reminded of what was happening. He, of course, made a statement, made a post, official post, and reminded that a year ago, Bucha survived 33 days of Russian occupation. And this occupation in numbers, 1,400 people were confirmed killed. This includes including 37 children. Over 175 people were found in the mass graves in Bucha and also in the torture rooms. In total, 9,000 Russian military crimes were confirmed in this area and is currently under investigation. Also, President Zelensky came to Bucha today together with leaders of Slovakia, Croatia, Slovenia, and Moldova. And there are certain commemoration activities and event happening today in Bucha because of this Bucha anniversary. So there is quite a lot of happening in terms of diplomatic and international scale.
Anna Chernikova reporting for VOA from Kyiv. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is heading to Brussels on Monday for a meeting of NATO foreign ministers that's expected to focus on sustaining support for Ukraine. The meeting comes as Turkey's parliament has approved a bill to allow Finland to join NATO, the last among the 30 members of the Western Defense Alliance to do so. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Lori London. The first Western tanks arrived in Ukraine this week, with dozens more expected in the coming months. Will it be enough, though, to help Kyiv drive back invading Russian forces? Henry Ridgewell reports.
British Challenger 2 tanks in Ukraine, ready to head into battle.
Thank you very much from Ukraine to the United Kingdom.
14 Challenger tanks are being sent to Ukraine. Britain's defence minister said Wednesday he could not speculate on any upcoming Ukrainian offensive.
But I think it is no secret that Ukraine is keen to start the process of rolling back Russian forces in the conflict. Obviously, the Russian forces are making almost no progress whatsoever.
Germany also confirmed it had delivered 18 advanced Leopard 2 main battle tanks to Ukraine, with Canada and Norway also dispatching several of their Leopards. European commanders say it could tip the balance in favor of Ukrainian forces.
They are facing this kind of tsunami of soldiers. So they are holding the front line. When they will be able to involve battle tanks like Leopard, they will be able to breach through and to look at counter-attacking.
Military experts estimate Ukraine now has a few dozen Western tanks. Is it enough to break through Russian defences?
At the moment, it's probably not enough, would be my hunch. But it's still fairly significant, you know, a battalion or two. Can form a spearhead.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said this week that his forces need more Western weapons before launching any counter-offensive.
The question is, can Ukraine protect, use and concentrate the Western weapons to such effect that they can break through better prepared Russian lines? It's not just about tanks, it's about the armoured infantry fighting vehicles, of which Ukraine has already got a lot of them. As far as I understand. So they accompany the tanks. It's also about the artillery pieces, the rounds that they need for their own guns, and the new artillery pieces that are coming in as well. So it's how you put the whole package together to achieve a combined arms breakthrough, if that's what you're going to do.
Ground conditions are changing. The spring thaw will turn frozen fields into quagmires.
It just makes movement and manoeuvre more difficult.
Western nations have pledged dozens more tanks and other heavy weapons. Slovakia and Poland are sending Ukraine their MiG-29 fighter jets. Russia, meanwhile, says it is ramping up ammunition production. British intelligence reported Thursday that Moscow is poised to launch another recruitment drive with the aim of signing up an additional 400,000 troops. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Meanwhile, former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev recently forecast it will be producing 1,500 new military tanks this year alone. Polygraph Info explains why that is false.
Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei marked the Persian New Year with a politics-heavy speech. Khamenei denied that Iran had been involved in the Ukraine war and blamed the U.S. for the conflict. In fact, it is the U.S. that waged the Ukraine war. In fact, the U.S. laid the groundwork for this war in order to expand NATO to the east of Europe. That is false. Washington's efforts to prevent Russia's invasion of Ukraine are well documented. The U.S. rallied allies to threaten Russian President Vladimir Putin with severe economic pain if he invaded, and launched what the New York Times called an unprecedented information campaign to prevent him from, quote, employing his usual denials to divide his adversaries. As for NATO expansion, Kiev was non-aligned and only dropped that status after Moscow clandestinely invaded Ukraine in 2014. Even then, NATO largely pursued de-escalation with Moscow. And Kremlin sources told Reuters in September 2022 that Putin rejected a provisional deal that would have satisfied, quote, Russia's demand that Ukraine stay out of NATO. While Khamenei denied Iranian involvement in the Ukraine war, there is ample evidence that Iran has provided Russia with attack drones to aid Moscow's war effort.
Polygraph Info is a fact-checking website produced by Voice of America. The website serves as a resource for verifying the increasing volume of disinformation and misinformation being distributed and shared globally. Oscar De La Renta, Calvin Klein, Alejandra Alonso Rojas, and many other designers produce their collections with hand-knit products made by Ukrainian women. It's been a year since Russia invaded Ukraine, and Ukrainian women continue to work despite the war. Nina Vishneva has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
On the pages of fashion magazines and on the catwalk, clothing pieces knitted by Ukrainian women can be seen in the world of high fashion.
Knitting, fashion, it distracts me from the most horrible things, from what is going on in Ukraine right now.
Lena, who didn't want VOA to use her last name, is one of many Ukrainian women who knit pieces of art like these, in some cases while working in a basement while shelling is underway.
Today I was calling one other woman in Kryvyi Rih regarding knitting, and she said, Lena, I cannot talk right now, there is shelling.
Lena supervises dozens of knitters all around Ukraine, including Kiev, Kherson, and Kryvyi Rih. They knit even when the electricity goes out, only by candlelight. Still, they manage to create handmade masterpieces that American fashion brands are including in fashion shows. Libby Tolm works with both the Ukrainian women and U.S. designers as the CEO of her Texas-based company, Elite Knitting.
We worked with Alejandra Alonso Rojas. We worked with Zach Pazan. We did some work for Calvin Klein as well.
Tolm says designers know the women's plight.
At the start of the war, Oscar De La Renta helped us a lot. They knew all of our knitters are located in Ukraine, so they created a GoFundMe page. And we were able to pay our knitters for 3 months of their work in advance, before we received a single piece from them.
Tolm says sometimes they don't hear from their knitters for months. With Russian forces destroying communication infrastructure, it is sometimes difficult for the women to get in touch.
Every time we ask them how they're doing, and every time we're afraid to hear what they have to say.
Tolm says many of the knitters had a chance to escape to Poland, a move that would have made their work easier. But she adds, so far, every one of them has chosen to live and work in Ukraine. For Nina Vishneva in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on social media, just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Lori London.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.